Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, and welcome to the Schmidt List, the podcast for people dedicated to managing successful projects, developing impactful products, and building engaged teams. And now, here's your host, Kurt Schmidt.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's show, episode 22 of the Schmidt List. This week, I've got an awesome guy, Jonathan Stark, joining me on the show. If you haven't heard of Jonathan Stark, he wrote a great book called Hourly Billing is Nuts, which it is. So you can listen to our conversation here. It's a bit of a long one, but there is so much to cover and so much to talk about. I really hope you take time and listen to the whole thing. And if you do, make sure you stick around till the end because I've got a few announcements to share with you. Enjoy the show. Tell me a bit about your background, Jonathan. How did you get into the web and then into what you're doing now in the consulting you're doing?
Sure. I've been doing computers since long time ago. I don't know, 80s or something. My dad got an IBM PC that had no hard drive. It was just floppy disk. And, you know, we played Zork and Ultima. Yeah. So computers have been a part of my life since sixth grade, junior high, around there. But music was my love. I went through music school, did that, did the sort of regionally touring musician thing, sleeping in vans and whatnot. Did that for a long time, but didn't make much money at it. So to kind of cover the bases in between, I would be either waiting on tables or doing things like Quark Express page layout stuff in the 90s, late 90s. And eventually ended up, one thing led to another, I ended up doing FileMaker Pro systems inside the internal agency at Staples.
Oh, yeah. I had my time with FileMaker back in the day.
Mm-hmm. So that was when I was really getting paid to do computer stuff. And I've totally fell in love with database programming, such as it was. I mean, FileMaker is pretty easy to use. I just loved it. I loved seeing I loved seeing my work on other people's computers. Like, wow, they're all using my little app that I built. And, you know, this would have been around 2001. And I dug it, but I was becoming dissatisfied with the job. I felt like I was underpaid. So I went and got a job at a consultant, one of the largest FileMaker consultants. They were in Atlanta. They had offices all over, but I went to the Atlanta office. Started there as a junior developer in 2003. And by 2005, mid-2005, I was the VP and I was managing folks. And at that point, I was getting very excited about the web, but I was still just doing FileMaker specifically. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to move to the web because one of the limitations of FileMaker is that people had to have the client installed. And I really wanted to be able to have anybody use my app and whatever that, mm-hmm. you know, my interface, let's call it.
Yeah.
And we got to a point where I came to recognize that our best developer was our least profitable. In fact, we were probably losing money on him because he was getting a nice salary. He was probably in the 90s, you know, per year back then. And we billed everybody out at the same rate. I think it was probably 150 back then. I can't remember. But, we're probably losing money on this guy. Meanwhile, we had what was basically an intern who was making half that. And, he was really slow and was making us tons of money. It was highly profitable. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, the sort of junior guy had a great bedside manner. His clients loved him. They were perfectly happy with the work. But it was, you know, it was not great work. It took a long time. It took a lot of, you know, it was just like, well, I couldn't figure it out. Like, and I sort of had a crisis of faith, and I was like, what's going on here? And after a long time, weeks of wrestling with this, I came to the sudden and almost violent realization that the problem was hourly billing. And from there, I couldn't look back. I was like, I kept asking myself, why is our best guy the least profitable? And what would we have to change to make him the most profitable? Because it seems like we should be printing money with this guy. He was great. And I recognized that the solution was value-based pricing.
Yeah, I see that a lot at agencies where you have people obviously at different salary points and they're all working through the same thing. One of the things I've heard you say before is you talk about that 1 hour at this time of day does not equal the exact same value for an hour later in the day, right?
Sure. To put it in the client, from a client standpoint, certainly, but also for a developer, whoever's doing the billing, whoever's tracking their time, you know, let's say you're a soloist, you work for yourself, you're a freelancer, and you work the first 40 hours, you're happy to take $100 an hour for that. But if they want 40 more, those hours are a lot harder, mm-hmm. you know, in that same week. You know, if they want 80 hours, those hours are a lot harder because, you know, there's only so much time in your life, and renting it away 1 hour at a time is a kind of painful thing to do. But so not all hours are created equal. I mean, it's not, people pay me $500 to jump on a phone call, but I don't think anybody would pay me $500 to wash their car in the same amount of time.
Right. I've also heard you talk about productized services. One of the things we do at Foundry is a lot of our front of the house, if you will, services are productized, where the consulting, the auditing, the workshops, all those things are usually a fixed cost versus the implementation, because mm-hmm. a lot of those things are very custom and they need to be estimated. They need to have some sort of idea around them. But the thing that I've found that's been easier in the past couple of years is definitely clients who understand that they're building a product versus a website or an app or things like that. They seem to be getting a better handle on that this thing is never actually done. Like, I've actually heard I remember years ago I'd be talking with a client and they'd be like, what do you mean it's never going to be done? Mm. I'm not paying for all this, but I feel like there's a better understanding in the business world around total cost of ownership. What's been your experience with that and having those conversations?
My experience is similar to yours. It really depends on the sophistication of the client organization. Mm-hmm. So if you're working with some cutting edge startup, they're going to understand that a lot more quickly than, say, a credit union that hasn't even built a single internal system for 20 years because they've outsourced everything. So, you know, it sort of depends, but the analogy that I like to use is it's a lot like a building. So if a client comes to you and says, hey, we need a new building. Can you, you know, and then they go through these phases. The first phase is you need something that looks like an architect to design the building. And that particular phase has a value. Then you need someone, you know, that's the sort of strategic phase, a design phase. Then there's an implementation phase where a builder comes in and actually builds the thing. Mm-hmm. And that's tends to be the most total, the highest dollar amount. It's usually stretched out. It's usually much longer than the design phase. It takes, you know, more bodies and all that thing. It appears to visually have more of a cost to the provider, the person who's selling. Mm-hmm. So it's really pretty easy. People expect to pay a lot of money for that because there's a lot of things going on, a lot of people involved, a lot of activity, a lot of busyness. So that goes along. And then once the building's built, then you need people to mop the floors. Mm-hmm. And people understand that they need to maintain a building. It's basically the same thing,
right,
in the software space. But, you know, that's good and bad because, I mean, the analogy holds at all three levels. So at the top level, the sort of design, architecture, that sort of thing, that is extremely high value, but it's usually a low amount of calendar time compared to the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And it's usually sort of one and done. you're sort of, you know, maybe it's a roadmap, maybe it's a style guide, maybe it's a marketing calendar, but you basically do it and you're done. And then there's a much longer implementation project that, again, it's something that, well, first of all, that architecture that designed the first strategic phase, hopefully you're not billing by the hour for that. That would be totally insane. Mm-hmm. What I see most people do is probably not bill for it at all because they want the implementation work and they just do that piece for free, sure. Which is even worse, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But then when you get to that implementation phase, that's where you see people, you see some people fix price it. You see some people use value pricing. You see some people use hourly, time and materials, that sort of thing. And it's I would call that medium value, all things considered. If you sort of divide it by the number of people involved or the, you know, person hours, then that is a lower value thing. It's a lower margin thing. And then at the lowest tier, the support, you know, the mopping the floors thing, no one who owns a building wants to pay that. That is a cost. That is hygiene. That's you know, it's brushing your teeth. Nobody, you know, does anybody enjoy brushing their teeth? I don't know. Maybe someone does. It's just something you have to do if you don't want the place to fall apart. So it's never going to be perceived by the client as a high value thing. Mm-hmm. They're just protecting their investment. And it's a cost that if it's too high, if a price for that is too high, then it's really going to bother them. It's going to grate on their nerves. They're going to look for cheaper solutions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take a lot of expertise to just maintain the status quo that was designed and built by someone who is more of an expert.
Do you find that you've run into clients that have been kind of trained around this hourly thing and want to see breakdowns of estimates and things for the work that you're doing when you are trying to sell value-based pricing versus you know, a typical spreadsheet with hours attached to it? Have you run into that situation?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are certain industries where it's a requirement, in fact. That so the procurement process for, say, the U.S. federal government or a lot of higher education institutions, they have to put things out to bid. And the way that they choose to compare apples to apples is by hourly rates, and whoever has the lowest one wins. So if you are, you know, so it's a bad fit. Value pricing or fixed pricing is a bad fit for organizations like that because they have no capacity to compare you to the other alternatives if you don't give them an hourly rate. They're mm-hmm. like, well, we can't tell who's cheaper.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I could give you a made up number, but that's not, I mean, because they're all just made up numbers anyway. I mean, where'd your hourly rate come from? You made it up.
Right.
So I could make up a number for you, but that's not going to tell you how much it's going to cost to achieve this outcome because it's just an estimate. And what I'll do, your customer or potential customer, so I'll give you an actual price. Like if you're going to buy a car, here is the price. Mm-hmm. And you know, people will say, most people, if they don't have a rigid procurement process, or if you're talking with someone far enough up the organization who has the ability to do whatever they want, more or less, you know, they can circumvent that sort of a situation. They tend to love it once they get past the surprise because virtually everything everyone buys in their lives is something that they know the price of before they decide whether or not they're going to buy it. You almost always know the price before you make a purchasing decision. It's extremely rare. It's almost hard to come up with examples outside of this industry where you don't know how much you're agreeing to before you agree to a major purchase.
Right.
So once they get over the surprise, it usually goes like this. So they'll say, hey, we heard you're amazing at, you know, mobile web design. Listen, we'd like to get a quote from you, but first, what's your hourly rate? And I say, oh, I don't have one. And there's a dead silence. And they say, well, how do you bill for your work? And I say, I'll give you a price up front and you can decide if it's worth the investment or not. Mm-hmm. And they're like, and then I'll say, will that work for you? Is that going to be okay? And they'll say, almost always, 99% of the time, if it's not higher ed or government, they'll say, yeah, that'd be great.
That's refreshing.
Yeah, exactly. They love it. And who wouldn't want to know the price?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I've got a background in project management. So fighting scope creep was really almost a art form, especially back in years 2010, 2012. I mean, I even remember going to conferences and seeing people talking to people that worked in agencies about how to get around estimates and how to get around how your scope creep, or how to actually perform scope creep in a way that you can get away with it with companies. I am not joking. I mean, I literally sat and listened to somebody talk about different tricks and tips you can do for your vendors to get around the what they considered scope creep, because we would argue all the time. Somebody would say, well, a number of things, right? This is just a tweak. This is a edit. This is not a change, right? This is a they use different words. It used to become a nomenclature war with people in order to try to avoid that scope creep. So when you're talking about hourly billing versus value-based billing, how's one approach to fight that idea of scope creep around there? What would be a suggestion you would have for people that maybe are uncomfortable with the idea because they're worried about scope creep?
Mm-hmm. When I hear people worrying about scope creep, it tells me that their margins are too low. Mm. So imagine, if you will, dear listener, think back to the last project where you felt like the scope creep got out of control. You had all of these fights with the client and it was a nightmare. And even when you were done and everybody was, you know, finally as satisfied as they were going to get at the end, it maybe wasn't that great of a relationship, probably ended on a bad note. Whenever you go over estimate, this is what happens. Imagine if you doubled, let's say your estimate was $100,000. Let's say you priced it at $500,000. Now, did it feel like scope creep? Or now are you happy to make all those changes? Mm-hmm. So the problem is your prices are too low.
Yeah.
So the question is, but of course, everyone right now is saying, but I would never have closed the deal at $500,000.
Sure.
How do you know that? What if you said, if you go into a client and you say, you start off by having a conversation, you know, they'll bring you in, your initial contact, they'll kind of give you a brain dump about the, you know, what's on their mind. They're thinking about the project. They're thinking about, they're probably thinking too far ahead about all these little details that they want. They're very excited about it. It's a big initiative. They want to get it done. It's probably already behind schedule. And you listen to that, you take notes, it goes on for 15, 20 minutes. They finally exhaust all of that information. And then you ask them to back up a little bit and say, all right, this is great, super helpful. Let's back up for a second. Why do you guys, I can see that you picked a way to solve this problem. Why did you pick this way? Why do you want to solve it in this way? Why wouldn't you just not do the project at all? Why wouldn't you just buy an off-the-shelf piece of software to do this for you? Why are you thinking about solving it this way? Why not just hire more employees instead of building this software product or building this website? Why not just build out your call center and push back on them and discover their actual business motivation for solving the whatever the business problem or capturing the business opportunity, whatever that is, find out what it is and gain some confidence that they're actually have chosen a solution that is going to do that for them. Because sometimes they just get excited about the idea of, you know, we need to have a blockchain product, you know, and they sell cars. And it's like, okay, I see you're all excited about this particular solution, but you haven't told me what the problem is yet. So let's just back up and make sure that this type of a solution is really the best use of resources. And I can't, because I don't want to take your money if you're not going to make it back tenfold.
Right.
So let's make sure first. Okay. Then they convince you, yes, this is the reason we can't use off the shelf. We have to do this. Then you work into, you know, why do you need to do this now? How urgent is this? Can't we study it for a while? Couldn't you do it in 6 months? How come you didn't do it a year ago? What changed? And you find out the level of urgency of the project. And then lastly, you say, well, why would you bring in someone expensive like me? I mean, you know, I'm not going to be the cheapest option. So why wouldn't you outsource this? Why wouldn't you hire some interns to do this? Why wouldn't you use your internal staff to do this? Mm. And they'll have answers for all those questions. Or you'll talk them out of doing the project and then you just dodged a bullet. So once you have all those answers, because you're writing notes furiously as they're telling you the answers to these questions and you write down their exact words, paying special care to capture any emotionally charged language, like freaking us out, or this would be huge for us, or you know, I'll kiss you on the lips if this actually works. You know, you write all that down, and then when you are convinced at the end of the project, at the end of the conversation, I call it a why conversation. When you're convinced at the end of that that there is a mutually beneficial, the possibility of a mutually beneficial relationship between you and this potential client, then you can say to them, you know, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm convinced that there's value in working together. What I'd like to do is go back to my office, huddle up with the team or by myself, you know, if you're a soloist. And I'd like to put together three options for you. They're going to range in price somewhere from $80,000 on the low end to $500,000 on the high end. Would that be okay? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, $500,000. Well, they might not. They might say yes. They might say, oh, $500,000 is way too high. And sort of like nod your head. I understand. I'll give you an option in the $80,000 range, but I do want to, I want to give you a full range of options. They'll say, okay, you know, what do they care? They can always say no. At this point, I have not even thought one bit about what I'm going to do for them. I haven't thought about how many hours. I haven't thought about scope. I haven't thought about whether I'm going to do Ruby on Rails or React Native. I haven't thought about that at all. Mm-hmm. I don't care. It doesn't matter. But what I have found out is how urgent the project is, why they can't use cheaper alternatives. I've found out why they need to do this specific kind of thing. And I've found out all of their specific reasons, not the general abstract reasons that we imagine people, you know, oh, we want, they want more efficiency or whatever. We have the exact language that the client themselves used to say why this specific thing was so important to them to invest in with a premium resource. So now I can go back. What that does is it gives me a sense of how much it's worth to the client. So they imagine that this is a very big deal for a very big company. It would be comical for them to make less than, let's say, $1 million a year of incremental revenue based on this alone, even if we only get halfway to the home run. So I can go back and I look at those. I look at their value, their probable rough value on an annual basis of this project, how much it's probably worth to the organization. And I'll say, okay, I kind of give myself a budget. Like, okay, if I was going to give myself a budget of, say, $500,000 to maximize the chances of this delivering that $1 million a year, what would I do? Pull out all the stops. Who would I call? Who would I put on the team? What team would I assemble? What are the things that I would do? Would I put people on site? Would I buy some, would I license some software? Now I have this almost like a budget where I can think very freely about how I'm going to achieve the desired outcome and say, oh, for $500,000, I would totally do all of this stuff. And then I'd have a nice 100% margin to boot. And then I'm, you know, do the same thing with the other options. So the highest option is the one that's the least risky to the client. It's the maximum chances of them achieving the desired outcome. On the low end, say that, I think I said $80,000 end, I might say something like, okay, you know, here's the $500,000 option, but $80,000 end, what we can do is sell you a block of 100 hours. There's no guarantee that we'll actually finish the project in that time. We have no way of knowing. There are still way too many things that are not defined. So what you can do is give us 80 grand. That'll buy you a block of, you know, whatever I said, 100 hours, 1,000 hours. It'll buy you this block of hours. You guys will do your own project management. You will set up set up Jira. We'll log in. We'll do the tasks. We'll bang through it. You won't have any access to the principles of my firm. It will really just be, we'll give you four bodies, basically. And then in the middle, you've got some option that is sort of, is a little bit like a more collaborative combination of your resources and their resources, and you know, more access to the principles of the firm and this sort of thing. So I think the important thing to point out there is that there's a big margin at each of those points. In other words, your cost as the provider is maybe half of the price that you set, because you've kind of reverse engineered what you're going to do to fit the price. And if you leave yourself some margin in there, scope creep becomes a non-issue. Like, I never, ever have worried about scope creep in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I've been fixed pricing the whole time, but I base my prices on value, not on time and materials. If you do a fixed price based on time and materials, you get killed every time.
Mm-hmm. And so do you find that, you know, that maybe there is times where some things go over what, I mean, because are you still, because again, like I've worked for some large organizations, I've worked for small organizations, and the word utilization comes up quite a bit, right? How well are these team members being utilized, right? So let's say I am doing that value-based pricing. Should I also be tracking my utilization? Like,
you mean internally for your own?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm being able to kind of prove the point that the value that we're placing around this is actually of value.
You could do that. That's a common question. But to me, it indicates that you're still thinking about it wrong.
Mm.
Again, to me, that's like, am I trying to maximize this investment I have in this person's salary? That's not the point.
Right.
You should be doing so much better. You know, so I think Blair Enns is like a genius at this when it comes to larger firms. So if you've got a 100, 200, 300 person firm, he is the guy. Mm-hmm. Like, he is the one that understands that. I mostly work with, you know, firms that are 10 or lower, mostly solo people.
Sure.
So a lot of this is, I credit Blair for, with larger firms. And honestly, I don't, you know, let me back up. How do you know if you're profitable? At the end of the year, you made way more money than you spent. You know, so like your P&L, that's what your P&L is for.
Right.
The necessity to break it down on a per person, per project level to me seems like it's timesheets.
Mm-hmm.
It's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know who your good employees are. They're the ones you like being around. And if you're making tons of money, see, I guess what I'm saying is when your margins are not razor thin, these things don't matter. Like, if you're floating checks all the time and worried about making payroll, mm-hmm. and who do I need to lay off, you need to base it on a very financial sort of, you know, bottom line,
right,
type of decision. But when you're doing well and you're delivering amazing work to clients who want to build a statue of you in front of their building because it was such a huge success,
mm-hmm.
these things evaporate into the background. A lot of this stuff comes from hourly billing because there is no profit in it. Profit is not built in.
One of the stories that you tell in your book, Hourly Billing is Nuts, which I really enjoyed because I have a similar one, where you talked about a client that wanted to talk repeatedly about their personal life and other things, mm-hmm. and you had a certain quota to bill by the end of each week. You didn't, mm-hmm. really know what to do at that time, right?
Yes. When I was still a developer employee billing, you know, I was still billable, basically. I was on the hook for, I think it was 30 hours a week needed to be billable, and we had like 10 hours a week that were, you know, for admin and going to the bathroom and lunch and all that.
Sure.
And yeah, and this one client, he was, I mean, we would be on the phone for hours. It was almost like pair programming. And it honestly got to the point where it felt very dependent, but he had tons of money and he really enjoyed it. It was almost like a hobby for him. And we kind of got close in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
So when things, you know, when we would finish working on some module of the system, he would tell me some story about how he proposed to his wife or how he talked his way out of a speeding ticket the other day. and he was an extrovert. So he would talk for a long time. And it was funny. And mm-hmm. I felt like it deepened the relationship, but it presented me with a problem, which was that I needed those hours. I needed to bill those.
Right.
So I call it pulling out the baseball bat. So I'd say, you know, listen, this has been great, but I have to get back to work because I'm responsible for a certain number of billable hours. Oh, yeah, okay, okay. And it would get better for a while. And then I'd pull out the baseball bat and be like, I'm putting down these 2 hours of chatter as billable. So through that conversation about your wife, you know, proposing to your wife at a Knicks game, $200. And you can imagine how he reacted to that. And then we would fight about that for 2 hours. And you should be somebody who's in a service business. I mean, yes, there's a certain limit. But if you're in a service business and a client wants to share personal details about their lives, you should be jumping for joy.
Yeah.
They trust you deeply. They view you as a partner. It's the ideal situation.
Right.
The reason it was not ideal was because I was billing by the hour. And if I had just given him, you know, I don't know, I'm not saying it would have worked in this case. If we had given him a high upfront price and we broke out each module and said, okay, this module is going to be $50,000. Do you want to go forward or not? Then, you know, he might have said no, but because not everybody's going to go for it. When they actually see the price, instead of like later, like, oh, I can't believe we spent that much money and we're feels like we're no closer to the goal. And it's like, yeah, because I'm supposed to be driving the bus, but you're driving it. Let me take the wheel. I'll get us there. And then you'll have the result, instead of this kind of like, you know, this weird situation where the client is kind of telling you what to do all the time and you just do it.
Personally, I've been in that situation where you've got an expectation for billable hours, but you've got a client that either, you know, wants to share a lot with you, or one of my most troubling experiences was I had a client that we started on a project. There was an estimate that was given, and we started getting involved in the discovery phase, and we started to see that there needed to be more discovery phase. They weren't as prepared as originally thought. There needed to be more meetings. There needed to be more discussions. There needed to be more paperwork drawn up or documents put together. And I kept telling this client, like, we're going over what we had originally scoped for. And this was years and years ago, but we're going over what we had originally scoped for. And, you know, for us to continue to consult with you, I need to issue a scope change. And this client wouldn't even talk about it. They were like, I am not paying for consulting. You guys are here to build this application, blah, 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 blah. And just went on and on and on. And I was beating my head against the wall because I saw the end coming and we were going to go over budget. And my boss is going to show up and say, what the heck is going on? Get on the phone and tell the client they got to pay more. I was just devastated. I was at the end of my rope. This continued for like 2 weeks.
Oh, I've had that happen for months.
Yeah. It was just insane for me. And at the time, finally, I just got to this breaking point, like you said, getting out the baseball bat in a way. And I told the client, I said, look, if you want to continue sitting around and brainstorming, then it's going to cost more. And they were like, oh, well, brainstorming. Yeah. I'll pay for more brainstorming. And I literally just changed the word from consulting to brainstorming, and the entire relationship changed. I remember driving home thinking like I was on another planet because I had been stressed so much for the last 2 weeks that now everything was fine. I sent them an additional thing for like 30 more hours or something, and everything was fine. Do you find that when you're talking about the difference between bidding things out of their value versus our, like, do you feel like the nomenclature has to change quite a bit when you're having those conversations, or do you feel like it's just more about how we're setting it up from the beginning and everything else is just as it should be?
That's a great point. So I want to mention a few things that were raised by what you just described. So one of the things that I often forget to tell people, and so I'm glad you brought it up, is that I never talk about value pricing with clients. This is inside baseball talk for us.
Right.
As far as they know, I give them a fixed price. This is the price. This is how much the house costs. Take it or leave it. And rarely, they'll ask me how I calculated it. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, based on past experience.
Right.
And that's the end of that. And if they, it's like, you know, what is it? Is there something wrong with the price? Do you need it higher? Do you need it lower? Like what? I mean, I'm not going to negotiate it, but it's fine. If it's too high, fine. Just tell me and I'll try and recommend a junior developer. I'll try and put you in touch with someone else who's cheaper. And, you know, this is all predicated on the notion that I have been saying all along from the beginning of the relationship that I'm definitely not the cheapest option. In fact, I will probably be the most expensive option. Are you sure you want to keep having this conversation?
Yeah.
So it has some to setting expectations. In terms of language, I never talk about how I set prices. I just say it's based on experience. Mm-hmm. There was one other thing you brought up there. The scope creep thing. So one of the things that I do to sort of insulate myself against scope creep is to be very, very focused at the beginning, in the proposal, in all of the early language, and I do make sure this is in the proposal. We focus on the goals and metrics that we can track throughout the process that will indicate that we are getting closer to the goal. There's very little, it's extremely downplayed in my proposals what I'm going to do. So I don't say, I give some information about what I'm going to do because I know I'm going to have to do it. Mm-hmm. It's utterly clear because certain things you do know at the beginning. I'm definitely going to have to do X, Y, and Z. So I'll put that in the proposal just so that they know that I heard what they said. And, you know, the proposal looks like the conversation we had. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to emphasize the outcomes. The outcome is it could be something super tangible like your conversion rate on mobile will double, or it could be something more intangible, but something we can measure, like employee morale or developer morale, that sort of thing. And I will talk about those outcomes, and then I will put a price on the outcome. And along the way, some of the things I said I was going to do, I might not even end up doing, but no one's going to care if we achieve the outcome.
Right.
And once you achieve the outcome, you know you're done. So it's not really a question of scope creep. Now, the thing that will happen is that, let's say you're in the middle of a software project, you know, it's a 6-month website build, maybe from scratch. And the sales director comes running in because their main competitor put a carousel on the top of the homepage, and man, isn't that cool. We should definitely add that into this project.
Always add a carousel.
Yeah. Got to add a carousel, right?
Yep.
I don't get into, oh, that wasn't in the original scope document. You know, my proposals are like maximum 5 pages long. There's no like mock-ups and, you know, like 100 pages of waterfall project description. I'll just say to the sales director, how does that contribute to achieving our ultimate goal, which is increasing developer morale or decreasing mobile, conversion rate on mobile? And if, you know, and I'll just challenge them to be like, all right, explain to me how that's going to help. If the person can explain to me how it's going to help, I'm going to want to do it.
Right.
Because that's going to get us to the goal. If the person can't explain how it's going to achieve that goal, and it's especially when it's obviously disconnected, they just kind of think, well, you know, you've got the hood open. We might as well change everything in the engine. So if that does happen, then I'll say, look, this is maybe a good idea, maybe not a good idea. I will add it to a V2 list. And when we finish with this project, achieve this goal, then we can revisit all the stuff on the V2 list. But I need to protect the success of this project. And so I'm going to say no to that for now.
Mm-hmm. And with that, have you ever had clients, I'm guessing in your contracts, you provide some sort of timeline. Have you ever had them try to reverse engineer your hourly rate out of that? I'm not suggesting that that's a thing. I've just, the dark side of me sees that happening.
No, not really. I do sometimes, and I don't agree to deadlines.
Right.
That's another thing that's unique about me because it's a fantasy and
sure.
It just sets the wrong expectation. And you know that the odds of hitting the deadline, because you're not in control of it.
Right.
You know, because it's a collaborative project is a collaboration. So you're not in control of the deadline. The CEO of the client company couldn't make you hit the deadline. Mm-hmm. So I just don't agree to them, but I will agree to maintain if that's the role or I'll agree to a sort of a living document of like, here's a possible timeline. Mm-hmm. There's no way in my experience, there is no way we'll finish faster than this. It will surely be longer than this, but I understand that people need to make, you know, marketing planning and all sorts of other planning they need to do. So I understand that they want to have some idea. I won't agree to a date, but I will say, look, I think this phase will be about this long. I think this phase will be about this long. On our weekly meetings, I will update this and I will show you how much longer it's getting because it's going to get longer. But I understand that you need some kind of idea, some kind of warning if we're going to, you know, miss an important date. Like there's a conference coming up, that, you know, a trade show, you know, CES is coming up and we need the firmware for our Bluetooth speaker to be working before CES or it's going to be a complete waste of $500,000. All right. Good to know. what I will do is I might agree to that deadline, but then I won't agree to the scope or the exact goals. I'll say, okay, here's a subset of the project that I'm positive I can finish by then. So there are certain ways to do it, but in general, I would never agree to a deadline. I would provide some kind of a timeline, keep it updated, indicate that it's going to be longer, and I'll update you every week. So the higher ups are cool with that. And I've never had a problem with that. Mm-hmm. And no, to answer your specific question, I've never had anyone reverse engineer. It's not even a question. I'm like, look, if you guys want someone cheaper, right, I can introduce you to people that are cheaper. So because of that, I get a lot of people who are like, yeah, would you? But then the people who I end up with are, you know, it's just the money's just not as much of a question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a quality client, right? And one of the other things you talk about in hourly billings, and that's I thought was really interesting. Another example I've had in the past, and I just kind of want to talk through this just for a second. You talk about a proposal teardown you did for somebody you were coaching, and you talk about how they were trying to estimate the value of the work they were doing to the business, mm-hmm. where you were saying, well, you know, instead of just saying there's no way to know, you could sort of kind of guess that by implementing this software, you're going to reduce the amount of administrative work that these employees have to do. And if I can guess that they cost you about this much per hour, this could save you X amount over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely had that experience before where we've done that. And the clients usually come back and said, well, that's not how much my people cost per hour, right? Or mm-hmm. they get a little edgy about that. We're assuming this is what their expenses are. And so I know that I've heard you talk about this before, kind of trying to figure out what is the value of the project that you're going to be doing, the value, the impact on the business. You talked mm-hmm. about all the questions you ask, and you've got a great list of them in the book. Is there anything else when it comes to that, when you're actually trying to get to numbers on the impact that would have, what sort of conversations are you having around? Is it around like, this will save your employees this much per hour, or you'll sell this many more widgets? And do you get pushback on that? How do you deal with those sorts of conversations?
Right. So yeah, let's drill into the why conversation a little bit more, because those are good examples. That's where I would find the information out. So when I put it in the proposal, it wouldn't be wrong, or at least be close. So at the point where I'm on my first why question, why this? You guys decided that you needed a mobile web designer to come in here and, you know, save your life. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what's the problem? Oh, our conversion or our cart abandonment's really bad on mobile. All right. Why don't you just add three customer service people and just have them email anybody that leaves their cart half full but doesn't check out. Well, you know, would that be enough? How many customer service people would you, why not just do that? You already have customer service people. You've already got 15 of them. Why don't you just add three?
Right.
And you know, what did that cost you? Fully loaded costs $300,000 a year. This would probably cost you more than that to do it with software. So why don't you just do that? And they'll say, well, we never really thought about it like that. But now that you put it like that, I guess we could. But then we've got the sort of care and feeding of those three additional employees. And we actually, our customer service department is already full. We'd have to add desk. We might have to move to a different building. You know, or I might ask questions like, it's in that why this section. I might say, well, why not just add two extra delivery trucks?
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, no, it would probably take 10 delivery trucks. And it'd be like, well, how many delivery trucks do you have now? I'm like, oh, we only got 7. Wow, so you'd have to more than double your delivery fleet.
Right.
So what that tells me, you know, and I probably have a rough idea how much this company makes revenue-wise. So I can do this kind of back of the napkin calculation of like, okay, you know, this software project is worth more than 10 delivery trucks, or, you know, it's at least, what it's worth
right.
to the company is roughly around 10 delivery trucks. So, all right. So if I set a value, if that's $10 million and I can set my price, therefore at a 10th of that and be, even if I'm wildly wrong about my rough estimates, I can say $1 million for this project and not even know what I'm going to do yet. But I just from talking to them, I can see that things are so screwed up that if I had $1 million budget, I could make things way better. Then, all right, $1 million and we can achieve these outcomes. Or if that's too much, you can go with my most risky option, which is the $80,000 option or whatever. But there's a book I'd like to mention for your listeners. It's probably the most important book I've read other than direct value pricing books. But there's a book called How to Measure Anything by, geez, what's the guy's name? We'll have to put it in the show notes. I'm spacing on his name. But it's called How to Measure Anything. And it's about how to measure intangibles in business. And when he says anything, he means anything. Mm. So morale, you name it. As intangible as you might think it sounds, legacy, brand, repute, so on and so forth. It doesn't have to be a bottom line thing like, okay, $10, $50,000 trucks equals blah, blah, blah. It doesn't have to always be dollars and cents, but they're going to give you dollars and cents. So you better believe that they're making a financial calculation in their head of how much it's worth for them to be able to be home every Friday for their kid's soccer game. Mm-hmm. So there is a number because they are forced to translate it into dollars to make a purchasing decision with you. So you can estimate it, at least to a meaningful level.
Well, sure. And if you're running a small business, you're also running those same calculations if you're determining whether to bring somebody else on or pay for an online service to do your admin for you or bring on an admin or all those different things, right? So the client's going to be doing the exact same thing.
Literally every time you make a purchase, you're doing this. Mm-hmm. What's the ROI on a latte? You don't know exactly, but you know it's worth more than $5 to you. But it's not worth more than $5 to someone else. But that's still a value decision. It's based on the value to you. You're not. Oh, I bought this, $5 latte, and now I'm $10 better. I mean, technically, you don't feel that way, but technically, it's true. So that's literally how every purchase is made, unless they don't know the price before they start, which is what happens with hourly billing. And that's why you get yourself in a jam.
You mentioned morale earlier too. I think there's another whole side of this, which is if it is yourself or it is a small company, the hourly billing can really affect the culture of the organization.
Don't get me started. I mean, people hoarding hours. I mean, it's people, forget about padding hours. I mean, hilariously, to my everlasting shame, when I was at Staples, the first widely distributed application that I built there was a time tracking, piece of time tracking software. So for, 100 or 150 employees at Staples, I built this time tracker, it was on their desk. And so hilariously, I would go, when I was designing it, because this is way before I thought any of this stuff, as I was designing it, I would go around and interview people like, okay, how are you planning on using it? What kind of interface do you need? Mm-hmm. How do you track your hours now? And I mean, please, I've got every confession straight from the horse's mouth from 50 people. People would wait till Friday, make it up and just stick it in. And anybody listening to this knows this is true.
Sure.
It's not malicious. It's just, it's administrative garbage that no one wants to do anyway. But you feel like you need it because your prices are too low.
Right.
So since your margins are so thin, you feel like you have, you do have no choice because you have to be so careful because your profits are so low.
What I've found in my leadership roles within these software companies is how you're incentivizing people. If you're incentivizing people to get 30 hours in by the end of the week, that's what they're going to do. If you're incentivizing people to provide as much value to clients as possible throughout the week, it's kind of hard to have both of those as rules. They mm-hmm. fight against each other.
The financial incentives are misaligned.
Yeah.
If you get paid by the hour and you want to raise, work slower. Done.
Right.
Even if you're at a McDonald's, that's the incentive. Work right. slower.
Yeah.
Why would you ever? So imagine you run a firm. You've got 500 employees. You bill them out by the hour. They all are doing digital work. They're editing movies. They are creating assets for websites. There were, Photoshop, Illustrator, Sketch, so on and so forth. Why would you ever upgrade their computers? Why would you ever give them faster computers? Well, it makes no sense. But the reason you do it is because they'll all leave if they have to work on slow computers. But now imagine if you are fixed pricing your projects, you'll run out and buy them faster computers.
Well, and you've got in a lot of places, you've got that dichotomy going on already, especially like you mentioned, a larger company. You've got the sales and marketing team, and then you've got the implement implementing team, right? You've got the designers and developers, and there's no way that the sales and marketing team are billing by the hour. And if you've got these two, it almost becomes two separate organizations kind of working against each other, is what I've seen in the past.
The thing with hourly billing, and anybody who's listening to this who is having a panic attack or just saying, just think I'm insane, and yeah, this is fine for you because you don't have any employees, all of that, that fear, that anger that you're feeling is that I'm asking you to take on risk. That's why you hate that. If you hate this, that's why, because right. I'm asking you to take on risk. But guess what? That's where profit comes from. So if you are, I mean, if you're doing fine, if you know, if you're, you've got your hourly machine working and you guys are doing okay and you're growing 5% a year, great. That's fine. You know, there's no reason to change. Ain't broke, don't fix it. But if you are worried about making payroll, or you cannot figure out how to grow your business, you're stuck at roughly $100,000, $200,000 profit per employee, and you can't get past it, adding more headcount is going to have diminishing returns. If you can't figure it out, the solution is to take on more risk. And by taking on that risk, you get sometimes massively more profitable.
That productized servicing is a great way to get started in this, because I'm guessing you're not suggesting just throw out the, you know, if you're going to make the move, it's probably best to start with something you're comfortable with, right? Something that you do over and over again, like make it into a product, sell it off the shelf at a fixed mm-hmm. cost. And that's a great introduction. That's a great way to get started.
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. I do not believe that value-based pricing for project is the only way to disconnect time from money. But I do believe that you have to disconnect time from money if you do ever want to become truly profitable. So there are a bunch of ways to do it. Productized services are a great way. It's mm-hmm. a very sort of low risk way for you to do this. In a, you know, you're not going to put yourself out of business by accidentally selling a strategy session for only $10,000.
Right.
You know, but yes, you will put yourself out of business, especially if you're small. If you run right out after listening to this show and take on a year-long project, wildly underbid it, because you will when you start doing this, you will still set your prices too low, even with value. So do it on a small project first, especially with someone that you have a really good connection with, maybe a past client, maybe it's a 2-week thing. Maybe it's just a short project that is not going to be a huge, you know, if you completely blow it, it's not going to kill you. Someone that you have great communication channels with, whether they're, you know, new and you just click with them, or you've got a good working relationship. But do start practicing it. I am definitely not, I mean, I probably sound like a wild-eyed evangelist, and I suppose I am, but I don't want to put a gun in somebody's hands, you know, like, and just like, whoops, sorry, destroyed your business. You know, so definitely do this. I want you to take on more risk, but I want you to do it slowly, and I want you to get a feel for it. And if in the meantime, especially for the bigger firms, I mean, in the meantime, you still have to bill hourly, because it kind of infests your entire firm. Like, everything's oriented around hours, all of your internal systems, all of your client mentality, all the expectations, probably your marketing, everything is oriented around hourly, your sales teams, everything. Proposal generation, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It is infested. It's like a virus in your whole organization. You can't just rip it out. You'll destroy the host. So you do need to work your way away from it. A nice thing to do is to start selling blocks of time, for example. Mm-hmm. Like I alluded to earlier, it's like, oh, here's 70 hours. We are not guaranteeing an outcome. We are guaranteeing that we will show up and we will work these 70 hours.
Right.
It will be, you know, X dollars paid in advance. And when we run out of hours, we'll tell you, and you can buy more or not. But no onesie twosies, no fighting about this one or that one. Mm-hmm. You pay in advance. None of this 60 days in arrears shenanigans. You're not, you know, you're not in the business of giving loans to your clients.
If you were to maybe give some advice to somebody who's maybe working in an organization, whether it be small or large or whatever, and they also feel that this would be a good approach. Maybe they want to make a change within their, they're not the president of the company or anything. What's some advice you would give them to maybe start spreading the good word about stopping just the hourly madness?
That's pretty hard. It is really hard. And the only answer I have is going to sound really self-serving because hourly billing is nuts. The point of that book is to change people's mindset. And if you are already converted, then give it to someone else, because that's the point of the book. It's not a how-to. It doesn't tell you how to make the change. It just tries to. I do my best to try to open people's eyes to how crazy it is. But it's like water for fish. We just don't even see it. The first thing you do when you go solo or you start your firm, the very first thing you do is you start figuring out, what's my hourly rate going to be? You don't even think about another option. You're just like, can I charge as much as that guy? He's better than me. What about, can I charge as much as her? Mm-hmm. Probably not. I should probably start a little lower. Or the most hilarious one to me is when someone looks at how much money they want to make per year and reverse engineer and divide it by the number of hours in a year.
Oh, wow.
I mean, come on. The world doesn't owe you an income for engaging in your favorite activities. You need to come up with something valuable to people. And once you do that, the sky's the limit. If you can find something valuable to folks and pricing it based on how much you need to make in a year would be wildly undervaluing yourself. I have one student who told me a story recently. He walked into an audit, and he walked in to the client. Within 10 minutes, he saw $1 million savings opportunity that could be implemented in days. And he only charged $10,000 for the thing. Your price should have been $100,000 for that one day visit. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no one will ever pay $100,000. And I'm like, these people wouldn't have. And he's like, maybe they would have, but they wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have known for sure that I could save them that much money. And I was like, all right, give them a money back guarantee.
Right.
It'd be $100,000 and I'll save you at least that in the first year alone or your money back. He would have made $100,000 for one day. And he presented that same thing to a second client and they were like, yeah, that makes sense. So, think about it. Here's a come to Jesus moment. If you don't know why your clients value your work, that's a problem. So you need to figure it out. And the way to do that is to ask them. So a lot of times people get stuck on this because they're like, well, I have no idea why. I mean, honestly, when you get right down to it, they don't know why their clients hire them. They don't understand the business outcomes. They just think of it in terms of, well, we built this website for them, so they owe us. We put in the time, they owe us the money. But they never even think about how that website is going to transform that business. Why did the person make that investment in the first place? Why did the client make that investment? A lot of providers, vendors, don't even think about that. So to the idea, the notion of setting a price based on value is just utterly foreign, which to me is horribly backwards.
Yeah. One of the things I read in one of your newsletters, which really hit home with me, was when you talked about how people get started in what they're doing, right? A lot of times they're copying other people and they're taking the same text off of another website and they're using it on their own and all these things. And then they get started and they start to see a little success in all these things, but they're not really differentiating themselves. And I think to kind of what you're saying, if you don't understand the value that you're bringing your clients, what the difference is between you versus Joe Schmo or Sally down the street, all they are going to do is just constantly be hammering about price, right?
Yeah, it's the only thing they understand about you and Sally. So the only you've got all this jargon on your site and your proprietary process and HTML5 and CSS3 and React Native and blah, 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 blah. It's all Greek to them. But what do they understand? They understand that you're $100 an hour and she's $75 an hour. So you leave them no choice. But if you talk about outcomes that you provide, business outcomes that a CFO or a CEO will immediately understand, we will increase your bottom line sales by 50%. I'm not saying you can do that, but you can probably, whatever you do, dear listener, you can probably affect some leading indicator that is important to your clients, whether that's increase traffic to their website by 50% or decrease cart abandonment or increase employee morale or convince the board to invest in a mobile solution because right now your hands are tied. All of these things are worth something to people. And when things are worth something to people, they will pay for them. But also the more important thing here is that they will understand your marketing. So your website's not just this contact form and a bunch of impenetrable soggy text that nobody understands. Like, we make smart solutions for hard problems, and we care more, and we're passionate.
Right.
And
solve problems through technology. That's my favorite one. That's on
we make hard things easy. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you do. I mean, you're a very busy guy. I appreciate you taking the time to join me today. Tell people about some of the work that you're doing. How can people find you? I know you do some mentoring. You have a newsletter. You have podcasts, all these different things. Where, if I wanted to engage with Jonathan more and learn more about value pricing, where's a good place to start?
Sure. Yeah. For folks who listen to this episode, the best, and don't hate me. If you still don't hate me after this episode, then you definitely should go to valuepricingbootcamp.com, and just a free email course, runs about a week. And I go in depth in writing, obviously, in a way that will continue to broaden the topics that we've talked about here. And then from there, you know, there'll be links to other things. I could list them off to you now, but there are a lot of them. So just go to valuepricingbootcamp.com and check that out. And definitely, if you have a larger firm, you should really look into Blair Enns' new book, just to promote someone else. Pricing Creativity is a three-ring binder manual for how to deal with this stuff if you have lots of employees. So if you're a larger firm, then, I mean, I'd be happy to, you know, you should do both, but definitely Blair's book is directly oriented to folks who have, you know, say 100 employees, that kind of thing.
That's great. Well, again, Jonathan, I want to thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure. I know I could talk to you probably for about 4 or 5 hours about this. And that's it. That's my conversation with Jonathan Stark. Make sure you check him out. His book is great. Hourly Billing is Nuts. Follow him on Twitter and LinkedIn. You'll find some really interesting stuff. So to the announcements, a few quick things. One is that the Schmidt List is going to be taking a little break for the next 2 weeks, building up some more content. So this will also give you a chance to go back and listen to some old episodes. And while you're doing that, I'm going to be hard at work on the next iteration of Foundry. We're going to be launching a San Francisco office here in the spring. So lots of work to do there. If you want to find out more about what we're doing and the products we're building, check us out at foundrymakes.com. That's foundrymakes.com. All right, you guys have a great week. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you.